Chris Lastagui and the Brass Fantasy with In the Still of the Night. I wonder if you can guess what my favorite instrument is in that whole getup of brass instruments. I wonder if you can tell. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, June the 13th. And you rule the airwaves today because it's open forum. This is a time we get together and you get to steer the conversation in the direction you think it ought to go based on stories you think deserve and warrant closer attention or ideas you would like to promulgate and present for consideration, or maybe you just want to just get something off your chest. This is the place to do it at 888-874-4888. I think it is vitally important that we get into the habit of conversing and even debating, even if we don't agree with each other. But especially if we don't agree with each other, to get into the practice of presenting an idea simply because it has integrity. It's not important whether you think you are, quote, right or, quote, wrong. There's no such thing. It is a matter about presenting an idea that you have put through some permutations and you've come to a conclusion and you would like to share it with the rest of us. So I look forward to your incisive calls today at 888-874-4888. Quite a few things, but again, this is not my time. This is your time. So we'll get to the stories that I want to present tomorrow. We'll continue with that. But the main thing is for you to really guide the program with those things that you think really should be discussed. They don't necessarily have to be news items, you know. They just have to be things that you think are worthy of discussion. And of course, as always, be prepared to be challenged, because you know some people may take you up on your ideas. And that's the way we need to go. I really encourage this. This is as important and as vital as a regular program on, you know, in which you have guests who come in and do their thing. Harvey from Berkeley, you're on the air. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Eutrice.
Hello.
Thanks for this program today.
Thank you.
And I'd like to talk about my idea for a national guaranteed income. And
okay.
The reason I talk about that is because we were behind the eight ball when they shipped our factories and our jobs out to lowest wages. We were behind the eight ball when they set up prisons for profit, our answer to third world labor. And I think that we have to get in front of the eight ball, and it's time for a national guaranteed income because we're up against something that is so revolutionary and going to change. It's like another industrial revolution, and it's the combination of three things that I know about. It's the artificial intelligence, robots, and 3D printers. And between them, I go to YouTube and I put in the word robots and just check out the latest videos on all the robots, and they're becoming very human-like. Especially the Japanese are developing robots they're essentially using them to help the elderly because they don't have a population growth that will be there for as the people retire. So they're implementing robots, and these robots are getting very, very human-like. In fact, one lady, when she saw it on the video clip, said that she felt emotional toward it, because it seems so human. And
let me ask you, though, I want to bring you back to your initial premise about the national guaranteed income. How would that work, in your view?
What it would be a safety net for people so they wouldn't end up on the street by being displaced by robots, artificial intelligence, and 3D printers. And basically, it would cover food, lodging, and I'm not quite sure to, you know, how to implement it. But the concept is there. And see, right now we have so many street people out there. We have massive populations that end up on the street because of the economy did them in, or for whatever reason. But we can prevent this if we shared the wealth in a different way. For instance, right now, a half of our gross national income goes to the military-industrial complex. And I feel that a lot of that money could be diverted into more social programs and a national guaranteed income. Because, you know, in the past it would be like they'd say, well, you know, you're lazy, you don't get a job. But laziness has nothing to do with competing against robots, artificial intelligence, and 3D printers. 3D printers are just in their infancy. It's like when you had the original black and white TV.
I've been reading on it.
Yeah.
Let me ask you.
Yeah.
Now, what about the counter argument to your argument when people say your version of a nationally guaranteed income is what exists now in the form of support services and social services for people who are poor, such as public assistance and housing assistance, that these subsidies are tantamount to a guaranteed income or some way of sustaining yourself without employment? So what is the difference? I mean, what is the difference from the model that you're proposing now?
Well, in my mind, the difference is that it's a matter of stress. It's like the stress of not having an income creates illness, and the public has to pick up the price of all that illness, whether it's drug addiction, alcohol addiction, eating the bad food. It's all about paying a price in one way or another for the populations that are going to suffer as these forms, these new types of industries move in. I mean, imagine having a little factory in every home that manufactures what you need. You don't need factories anymore. Imagine having artificial intelligence where when you buy a computer, it'll seem more like a friend, and combined artificial intelligence with robots will, you know, I mean, a robot works 24 hours a day. It doesn't require any kind of medical insurance or retirement benefits. Who are you going to hire if you had the choice? Would you hire a robot or would you hire a person? It's going to come down to that. So that's why we need to have a support net. Now, I think this could be something wonderful too. It sounds like a threat, but you know, a lot of jobs that humanity does is very mundane, repetitive, and boring. They can't wait to get away from it. And so the robots, the artificial intelligence, the 3D printers will do these things so that we will be freed up to realize our true potential, which
all right,
is
well,
the arts,
you put
the education.
You put your idea out there. It's in the ether. Let's see who reacts to it. But thank you. You got the ball starting with the need for a guaranteed income. Thanks so much, Harvey, for being with us today. Thank you. Michael from New Jersey, you're next.
Well, I didn't call up to respond to Harvey, but
I know.
I'd like to say a word. I actually agree with a national guaranteed income, but I don't see it exactly the way Harvey sees it. I see it as just scrapping all the safety net, scrapping Social Security, all these payments, and lumping them together and taking that money and giving it each family or individual $50,000 a year, and then take care of yourself like that. And it probably is a low figure, because if you group all that money together, I'm not an accountant, I'm not a bean counter, but there's an enormous amount of money in the social programs that the Republicans are screaming about. Just lump it all together and pay everybody $50,000 or $65,000 a year. So I think that would work out much better. Then we could buy the insurance we want. We could end corruption, because we could just buy, you know, we could end the corruption of the social network programs, which corporations have inveigled to steal from. But I'm going too far with that. I really wanted to talk about this issue of this dichotomy with security versus privacy.
Go ahead.
Okay, so basically, you know, we do live in a world of laws and not men, but ultimately we do live in a world of men, and the laws don't really solve our problems, and men live in disorder. And I guess you could just ask any woman about that. But
that's funny.
So men or a man, I think, has to change rather than conform to certain standards, you know, engage in reforms, be directed by laws, because men will find their ways around laws to do whatever they want. And if we just look at the government and what it's doing, they don't respect the law. And more importantly, they don't respect due process. And I think I'm not a lawyer, so if I throw out a term, it's because I look on the internet. I'm not a legal scholar by any means, but there is a saying that nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So these folks that are process all our data to get what they want, listen into anything they want, etc. We completely do not have due process in any of that. Due process means that any governing body or authorities have to respect the rights of the average citizen.
Are you comfortable, though, Michael? You're clear about the government not having the right to do that, but does it equally trouble you that Facebook or Yahoo or Google or whoever else, Pandora, name any one of these big outfits, they do essentially the same thing in a different way in terms of...
They mine our data too, right?
In the sense that today, and I had talked about this in earlier segments, information is highly monetized. Information is going to be, in fact, the basis of a huge part of the economy, and not in the way that we are accustomed to thinking. We think of information in terms of, you know, technology. I'm talking about you are going to have to pay to get information of any type at some point soon. You want to know, you know, what the average rainfall is in the Amazon forest? Fine. Put down your credit card, and for $5.99, you'll get the answer. And that's exactly where it's headed. You see the incredible amounts of, just unimaginable amounts of information being aggregated. Bill Gates buying up entire libraries and so forth. These are indications of where things are going, the information and the access to information, and then a further refinement, the access to relevant or specific types of information will cost the average consumer, and that's where it's going. But Obama actually got elected on the application of this, and this is what made his machinery, the machinery of election, so unique. They knew exactly where their voter was. They knew everything they needed to know about that voter: income, gender, number in the household, thoughts about birth control, thoughts about social security, and so forth. They have quantified and harvested all this information and were able to extract all kinds of profiles to put these numbers and pieces of information and profiles together. This is where it's at. So in a way, we have let a huge segment of the economy get by with the same thing that we say we wouldn't tolerate in the government. Of course, the government's proposal is a little bit deeper than that. They actually are looking to go deeper, but the essential idea of people having information that you would consider private as a consumer, and all kinds of things are being done with it without you knowing right now. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, I agree. I think this has been going on for a long, long time, back to the 1920s and the 40s even. I just don't think it was so technologically advanced, but, you know, people have been collecting data, you know, interestingly, I'm working out something for my mother and her veterans. I'm putting on my social worker hat, and I have to apply for veterans benefits. My father was wounded in the war. And I'm looking through his papers, and I see they collected a lot of data back then, too. You know,
sure.
On everybody, you know, height, weight, eye color, and this and that, going back into, whatever it was, 1930s or whatever, 40s. And so the bureaucracy has been growing, but they just found ways to exploit it. And since, you see, I agree with you in a lot of, going back in a lot of programs, we were talking about the laws really weren't made for us. They were made for the landed gentry. And today, the landed gentry have become the corporations. They've switched from the landed gentry, and now the corporations are writing the laws that best serve their purposes. And so, if the laws suggest that there's not too much difference between the people who write the laws and or pay the money to the people who write the laws, and the government, so.
We're also seeing a confluence of interests, and it's really incredible. It's happening in front of our eyes, but we are seeing only half the problem. You remember we had Joel Kotkin here talking about the rise of the new oligarchs, and the new oligarchs he talked about were the technology people.
Correct.
And They have a vested interest in a lot of this. I mean, when you have a corporation, such as the company that Snowden worked for, having 99.something% of its revenue based on Defense Department contracts, and they are a huge corporation. And this one corporation, its entire revenue stream is predicated from the Department of Defense. So you see the confluence of interests between the high-tech world and government. And this is really what we ought to be scared of.
I agree.
The government is going to do its thing.
I agree. When they said at the beginning, I don't want to take up the whole time, but I could, but I don't want to. At the beginning they said, we the people, but we the people turned out to be the landed gentry, and they wrote the laws,
sure.
And there was slavery at that time, and they wrote the laws. Mm-hmm. And so that everybody wasn't included in the law. It was a certain group of people. And I think we've got the same thing today with the corporations. And, and the people behind the corporations, who are those landed gentry with all the money, whatever. And they've, they've kind of taken over the whole territory, and they sort of brainwashing us with these books they come out with, Lean Forward, and, the person writing the book is a billionaire, and be like me,
Yeah.
And it kind of nauseates me, the whole thing. But the business of it, which I think we have to have this discussion, go on to another day, because I was perusing the internet, to see, do I have a right to be left alone? Do I have a right to privacy? Do I have a constitutional right to be left alone, to be private in my affairs, etc.? And it's not so clear. I mean,
that's a great question. Let's see if we get an answer. But
okay.
It's an intriguing question. Thank you so much.
I think we should have another day on this, Eutrice.
Yes, I think so too. Thank
okay.
you.
You're welcome.
Hello, Alex from New Jersey. The number is 888-874-4888. Alex, you're up next to bat.
Great show, like always, Eutrice.
Thank you so much.
Here's what I guess I've turned and what I've noticed about humanity. It's pretty interesting. I call it the ostrich syndrome, meaning that we all kind of see the idea or the picture or the concept of an ostrich sticking their heads in the ground, in the sand. Is that correct?
Yes, that's what it said, but they don't
okay.
actually do that.
Okay, they actually do that. Well,
no, they don't.
Huh?
They don't put their heads in the sand. That's just,
it's
a figure
like a
of speech.
It's a cartoon thing. Right? It's like a cartoon concept.
Yeah, right. Uh-huh.
So think of it that way, as a cartoon concept of humanity. Most people are like this, and here comes the incredible thing. They stick their heads in the sand right in the middle of a railroad track. Then in the distance, they hear like a whistle, you know, underneath the sand, and they still don't see what the hell is coming towards them. And then the whistle becomes louder, and then the rumbling becomes louder, and they still won't stick their heads out of the sand to see what the hell is happening because they're right in the middle of the railroad track. And then it gets louder and louder until eventually, like humanity, like people in general, most people get hit with the train just because they won't stick their heads out of the sand to see what's happening. But here comes the most incredible thing of all. If this ostrich gets hit by the train and barely survives the hit of the train, guess what the ostrich does again? Most people, they will go back again, survive it, and go stick their heads back in the sand again.
Okay, so you've beaten the heck out of this metaphor, so tell us what it means.
That we don't have a prayer. We don't have a prayer because we're going to get hit by the train.
But why are you so pessimistic?
Because
why do you think you don't have a prayer?
Because that's just the reality of humanity. And then I got another conceptual thing.
Yeah, but before you go, let's make you accountable to your own idea. Have you at one point or the other stuck your head beneath the sand?
Most of us that are awoken, we're kind
no,
of...
No, 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 I'm asking you, have you personally done the very thing that you're pointing to today?
I don't think that I have. I've seen family members and other people in government and people in government doing these things over and over again. And then getting hit with the consequences and dealing with them.
The point I'm making is that what you are alluding to and what you were you've illustrated is a very human reaction. It's not unusual, and it's not necessarily unique to human beings. By the way, a lot of other creatures just stand transfixed in the eyes of danger. But
saying that we're aware.
Yes.
Of what's coming towards us.
Right, but sometimes the feeling is...
We become frozen, and then...
Yes, but I'm trying to say to you is that what you are pointing to as highly irregular behavior, I'm suggesting is highly typical behavior.
Correct.
Nobody really wants to face unpleasantness, especially predictable unpleasantness. Nobody wants to confront something that they feel they have no power to overcome, really.
Correct.
So it is just part of human, the human values. Sometimes you feel so overwhelmed. You can't begin to cope with trying to find an answer to anything. Like today, this morning I was reading that this building supervisor, there was a building that collapsed in Philadelphia, you might have heard it, where six people were killed. The building that they were trying to bulldoze fell on an adjacent store, and six people in that store were killed. The building inspector killed himself. Now, you and I would say, well, why would somebody feel so responsible for the fact that a crane operator, it wasn't his fault, the crane operator's fault. It turns out they said that the crane operator might have been high at the time he was operating the crane and therefore caused the accident to occur. But human frailty is such a thing that we never know when we might feel completely outdone by the challenges of life. We just don't know that. And sometimes the problems that confront us, we just don't want to deal with it. You know, it's you just don't want to deal with it. And sometimes you just can't deal with it. And it hits you that the problems are so vast, you can't even begin to make a dent in it.
Well, I'm saying look at people's health. You know, people can take care of their health, and they just continue doing their diet and the fast foods and all that until they get hit. They get hit with a heart attack, get hit with a stroke. But like I said before, the ostrich syndrome says that even after you get hit with it, most people will go back and stick their heads back into the ground again and do the same things all over again. And it's just like this magical thing that people probably believe, most people believe that if they stick their heads in the ground and in the middle of a railroad track, that the train magically will go around them.
Well, you know, I'm saying I understand your metaphor, but I'm saying also keep in mind that that is very, very much a part of being human. Our capacities vary very widely. There are people who can cope. There are people who can't cope. There are people who decide that it's not their job to even think about coping. And so, you know, we have to put all of that in the mix. That's what makes us human beings. Thanks, Alex. Great contribution. Thank you. Dave from Brooklyn, you're on the air. 888-874-4888. We're having some very deep ideas being thrown into the pot today.
Hi, Chase.
Hello.
I want to take a shot at your opening question, among other things, but two side issues, and then. But anyway, what I think you might have been referring to as the instrument that you liked most in that opening piece by Lester Bowie.
Oh, yeah.
I suspect it's the tuba.
That's it. You hit it. Oh, how did you know?
Well,
the
tuba was the bass instrument in that, and it played a very prominent role in that piece, as do in most modern music. The rhythm line is the most underappreciated, but the most important aspect of modern, you know, music, but most modern music, and that tuba, and the tuba especially, the tuba was what made so much of early jazz what it was. And but I got to say, Lester Bowie, he has a unique style of playing the trumpet, and that also
he does
heavily colored that piece. So.
Yeah, he was a favorite of mine. And, you know, I liked it because he just used to wear this wild lab coat. I still don't understand why the lab coat, but he wore the lab coat whenever he was performing, or he put some glitter, extra glitter on the lab coat, probably to indicate, you know, he's a technician, I guess, but music was really great. So how did you guess it was the tuba? This is fascinating.
Well, you're absolutely right. Listening to the music and Lester Bowie's trumpet, because it is a kind of a unique trumpet, would have been the obvious choice, but I figured it can't be that. And and the next thing was the tuba. That was what was really making the music what it was. Well,
yeah.
I can't say that, but something akin to that.
So what was your contribution?
Well, I have one other side issue, and I can always leave the other stuff if you know, you have other people to go to, that's okay. But stimulated by one of the earlier callers, a kind of a phraseology that he used when he referred to man and man is this and that. And I'm thinking nowadays people, especially because of the awareness of the women's movement, about that version of sexism built into the language and how, you know, all-encompassing it is. A lot of writers now have been trying to get away from that sort of usage by doing various what I consider clumsy attempts at getting around it, namely using the feminine pronoun instead of the masculine, or else using his or her, you know, various constructions like that. I have always felt, and you being having a background in journalism and editing and all of that, I figured, and being so articulate, I thought you'd be the perfect person to ask this.
Let's see.
I think that using the plural pronoun, like some other, like French and Italian and Spanish do, you know, they use the plural pronoun for more formalistic individual second person usage. And I think that would work perfectly well in English in most cases. So
illustrate your point. Illustrate it.
Let's see. How pronouns refer back to the noun, and so let's say you used
Sentence. Put us a sentence that illustrates the point you want to make, and we'll see how it goes from there.
A person went to the movies. I'm just making this up on the fly. A person mm-hmm. went to the movies, and then found the wallet that he or she lost, let's say. You were using it in a general sense. Like, if a person goes to the movies and then, instead of saying that person, you would say he or she decides to do something. But whichever one you say, usually you would say he decides to do something just because the common usage is the male pronoun, which refers back to the original noun. And rather than using the male pronoun he, you would use the plural pronoun they. And I would think it would work perfectly well. So the man went to the movies, and then they decided to do something.
No. Well, now you have a big grammatical problem. Well, there are personal pronouns, he or she, and there's also the impersonal pronoun, one. And in the old English application, it would read something like, when one goes to the movies,
right.
one should not bring popcorn from outside. But, I mean, that's an old kind of configuration. But it is grammatically incorrect to use a singular pronoun with a plural verb. So you can't say, when one goes, they... You see, you know.
Yes, I see. But okay. That's right. Just the convention, is it not? And conventions can be changed, just like in
well,
those...
conventions have to change in a way that is more widespread than the individual commission of grammatical error. if it were understood that this is how people are expressing themselves broadly, then you could construe it to be, you know, par for the course in terms of a slight change in the grammatical rules. But the he or she thing is very clumsy, too. So I wrestle with it, too, when you're writing and you want to indicate, you know, it's an impersonal pronoun, but you have to put something there, and you end up with the he or she or he slash she. You know, it gets ridiculous.
Yes.
So maybe we'll just have to pay attention to see what the society is saying before we make a general grammatical change.
And one more observation, by the way, you know, like in Spanish, they use double negatives all the time. It's not a problem in Spanish. And again, I use the example of the fact that when you're using an intimate you, referring to an intimate you, you can use the singular pronoun, but when you refer to the formal you individual, you use the plural pronoun, and it's not a problem in those languages.
Well, you're right, but you're kind of off there, because the formal use is not singular; it's both singular and plural. You have the formal version, and you have the informal version. So I would not walk up to a woman that I would consider, you know, an adult, an older person, and address her as tu. You know, tu is the more familiar, a more familiar expression to say you. You know, I would not say that. I would address her very differently so that I communicate a certain amount of respect for her stature in the community. These are just rules. Every language has their own, its own, see, there we go. Every language has its own peculiarities. Since we're into grammar now. Okay. But it's the same with French. You know, they have the formal and informal ways of speaking. So that's
good.
It's interesting things about language. Thank you so much, Dave. Great talking with you. And thank you for just getting it right. You knew it was the tuba, and that pleases me. You can't tell how much it pleases me to know that you were able to tell that. Thanks a lot. We'll take this break and share some messages about great programming here at PRN.FM. And in the meantime, flex your fingers and dial 888-874-4888. We'll be back right after this. Listening to PRN.FM, this is Lead Stories. I'm Yatrice Lead, and you tell us where you're going with the conversation today at 888-874-4888. Well, look where we have been. We have had a discussion on national guaranteed income, the right to be left alone. We've had a discussion about human behavior and the propensity to bury our heads in the sand in the face of imminent danger. We had the joy of tuba and a dissertation on grammar. See how far what the range is of this brilliant audience. So what do you have to say? What do you want to talk about? This is the time to do it. Make yourself heard. 888-874-4888. I just want to encourage you to join me in doing one little piece of business, and it is for the sake of children who are dying. They really are in a very bad way in Haiti as a result of the storm. So many children are, at risk. The situation is so dire. And all we want is to encourage people to call the office of Frederica Wilson, and she is a congresswoman of the largest district in the United States with the largest number, I should say, of people from Haiti living in that congressional district. It is called the Family Reunification Project, and we want to urge Congresswoman Frederica Wilson, who happens to have a great deal of influence in Washington and certainly with the president on these matters, to ask her to call the president and to impress upon him the need to give this green light. Everything has been in place, and they've been waiting and waiting for no particular reason. There's no money that has to be spent. There's nothing, no legislation that has to be passed. And all we need is to get this logjam removed so these children can get to their relatives and be taken care of properly. 202-225-4506 is the number, 202-225-4506. Call and politely and respectfully request that she urge the president to direct the Department of Homeland Security to expedite Haitian family reunification today, right now. That's the message. That's all you have to say, and you would feel better for it. We're trying to get this project going, so on humanitarian grounds, because the situation in Haiti is really awful, and the children literally are dying now. So we have to do something to help. And all we have to do is just make that phone call. And it would impress upon her the need to move faster and to get the president to move faster. And it certainly would signal to the congresswoman that people are watching. And we are concerned that as a representative with the district with the largest number of Haitians in the United States in it, that she is doing a proactive thing and a very good and humanitarian thing by urging the president to expedite this program. Again, the number is 202-225-4506. Okay, and we're back to your calls at 888-874-4888. I'm just a traffic cop today. I'm directing traffic, but you are the traffic. You and your ideas, just put them on the table and let's see what you have to offer. This is very, very important to be able to do, to get used to the idea of talking with each other, especially when there are very sharp disagreements and differences of opinion. One of the things I think our community, when I say our community, I mean the community of people who consider themselves a progressive, is that we don't tolerate dissent very well. We don't tolerate differences of opinion very well. And it is shameful because we begin to lose assets that we really should have. And it's okay to have a difference of opinion. It's okay to think differently from somebody else, but engage it. That's one of the things that the right has done so effectively. They disagree, and of course, 90% of the time, they're just plain wrong, but they are brave enough to confront the opposing point of view. And you have to give credit for that. And that is what has made them so successful in many ways, that they don't mind taking on the opposition, even when they're absolutely dead wrong. But you always have to be magnanimous. Of course, I appreciate your point of view, even though you're dead wrong. I support your right to say what you're saying, even though you're dead wrong. You know they say the same thing about us. So the thing is to just get used to the idea of putting forward your views without feeling constrained in any way to toe the line. You should be able to speak freely. I have, I think, a very different point of view about this whole leaking of, the Snowden, Ed Snowden and his leaks and the kinds of things that were going on. I have problems with that. And the problem I'm having is not so much that, certain things are coming to light. We see, the report. We have no independent way of confirming it. We could only report what he says, I suppose, and that constitutes the stories for the most part, because certainly nobody would be called to confirm or deny. But it troubles me on a different level. This whole thing is resonating very differently for me. And it has to do with the age-old encoded ways of behavior, which relate to the perceived position of authority and power in our society. Here's a guy, he's 29, and making a very good living as a high school dropout. And because he happens to be conversant with technology. I don't believe, by the way, despite the impression that he was a very, highly placed asset, I just think, he certainly might have known a lot more than the average coder did, but he's not very high on the food chain within that industry. I know people who are in that industry, and, they're very low-key. You would never know. But nobody put a gun to his head and said, you know, kidnapped him and waterboarded him and, you know, hypnotized him and compelled him to go work for the CIA. And for crying out loud, if that's where you're going, why are you so surprised that you discover that it is exactly what it is? What is the surprise there? But that aside, what troubles me is the acceptance, across the board acceptance, and this is really what we ought to be discussing. What informed this person to behave this way? And to behave this way, I mean, it wasn't just about leaking information, the value of which, you know, we are in no position to determine. You know, we don't know. For us as lay people, it may sound impressive. For people operating at a particular level, it's really not that big a deal. The information being leaked is not that devastating. But I'm more fascinated by what informed his behavior. And it could only be that by age 29 and probably earlier, he had been sufficiently schooled in the prevailing ways of thinking in a class which he thinks he occupied and within a racial context that reinforced this kind of thinking in him, that he was at least equal to, if not more powerful than, many in society, and as in one individual had as much right individually to exercise that power, even if it might have deeply affected the outcomes, intelligence gathering outcomes for the entire nation. Now that's real, real deep stuff. And I've seen it a lot. And it comes from that conditioning in our society where some people believe they are naturally imbued with these rights of authority. I mean, you know, most people without a high school diploma getting paid as much as you live there, oh boy, I've hit it big. His thinking is, something is wrong there, by the way. We're not connecting with it, and nobody is interested in going it. But within a matter of observing this man for a little while, you get a clear feeling that there's something wrong there. The pistons are not all firing. He had the same kind of dead look in his eyes as you saw in those spelling bee champions. You know, they're physically there, but they're emotionally distant. You get the feeling that these kids, they need to be, you know, they need to be rescued because they come across as emotionally dead. But just the same, they harbor a real deep-seated kind of power or feeling of power. And they can't wait to exercise it. And in a sense, this is a very narcissistic thing to do. And still come out of it, I'm doing this and I will suffer more than anyone else. I'm absorbing the pain of doing the right thing. You know, there's just too many contradictions in what he is saying and doing. And that bothers me. You know, whether people choose to leak things or not to leak things, I mean, this happens. But I have been in the world of, in the professional world, where individuals take it upon themselves to create havoc when they cannot get their way, or when it is, in their view, within their right to utterly disrupt and destroy something simply because they believe themselves to be harmed in some way. And so they want to destroy everything, even the very thing that keeps them fed. this is a very deep conversation to be had, and we have to broach it in intervals because each step of the way is a really deep step. It is the same reason why a child, a kid, 3 or 4 years old, could look at a grown man and call him by his first name. Nobody sat that child down in a school and said, well, this is what you must do. But the signals are clear in early childhood in this country in the way race shapes our views and shapes our behaviors and informs our actions. It gives us the information we need to operate at a level we believe, you know, is just our right. It is our right to, in his thinking, it is his right to throw the whole world into chaos because something, some switch went off. And you can see, looking at this person, that there isn't that kind of, you look at his eyes and you see a person who is physically there with you, but not all there. This, by the way, is characteristic of people who are deep into computers and sciences. They are comfortable with being alone and isolated. They're comfortable with being super introverted. They're comfortable thinking their thoughts and having the, a private little joke that they know what's happening and you don't. And they betray nothing. You know, you would see them, they would smile and everything, but all the while they're spending nights planning for you. There's a lot more to this Mr. Snowden that probably will reveal itself. And what you will find is, and it goes beyond whatever his intent is, because I believe that his intent also was not healthy. It was not a healthy thing to do. And even though people are, you know, supporting him and hailing him as a champion, I do not see him as a champion at all. I see him as somebody whose disconnectedness, and we shouldn't learn the reason for that. And the fact that a CIA is not smart enough to really study the profiles of people working for it when they're handling these kinds of matters, you know, and they spend all this time and effort ascertaining the emotional and psychological profiles of, quote, the enemy, unquote. And we've seen enough examples of people on the inside doing things that are really not good. This is not to say that I agree with the fact that the government has this superhuman appetite for power and will exercise it. But I accept that as typical governmental behavior. It's not a surprise to me. But Mr. Ed Snowden is a puzzlement, and I think we'll get to learn a bit more about him and what motivated him to do what he has done. Well, we've come to the end of our program today. Thank you so much for participating and sharing your thoughts. And we return right here tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Tell people about this program and about PRN.FM. And let's tune in again and be together again tomorrow, just at the same time. Thanks.